With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Challis, Idaho was idyllic. In 1993, it was the type of small town where everyone knew each other and kept their doors unlocked. Children played outside and only came home when it was time for dinner. Nothing can last forever, though, and on October 11th, 1993, everything in the small town changed forever. It was on that day that 9-year-old Stephanie Crane said goodbye to her friends at a bowling alley and vanished. Stephanie's disappearance was incomprehensible, not only to her family, but to the residents of the tight-knit town. In fact, her disappearance would have lasting effects on everyone who lived in Chalice and would be just the first of many tragedies that struck the Crane family. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Stephanie Crane. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
We don't have any new news for you today. We're going to get right into the story of Stephanie Crane. Stephanie Lynn Crane was born on September 28, 1984, in Chalice, Idaho, to Sandy and Ben Crane. Stephanie was the oldest of four children. Three sisters followed her, each 2 years apart. Stephanie was a good big sister, but her interests were geared more toward fishing and playing outside than playing house. Because of this, she was said to have been closer to her father, as her mother was busy tending to the younger children. As I mentioned in the intro, kids in Chalice had a lot of freedom. Stephanie walked to and from school on her own, and she was even part of an after-school bowling league with her friends.
A bowling league?
I know, for little 9-year-olds.
That's cute.
That's adorable, yeah. So on October 11th, 1993, Sandy gave Stephanie money for a snack at the bowling alley, and she and her friends walked to the nearby Chalice Lanes to bowl after school. After bowling ended, Stephanie was to walk home and be there by 5 p.m.
So was this bowling club, was it like organized by anybody that you know of, or was it just like, a group of 9-year-old friends that got together at the bowling alley?
I don't know. I think it was like a program through the bowling alley, but I'm not entirely sure. It really could have just been a group of friends who are like, let's have a bowling league. I don't know.
That's insanely cute.
Yeah. So at the time, of course, nothing seemed odd about this outing. I mean, it was a league. It was this planned thing that they did on a regular basis. So nobody thought twice about it. Around 4:45, bowling ended and the children went their separate ways. And Stephanie set out to make the 5-minute walk home.
So it's 5 minutes from her house.
Yeah. And so Sandy met her to give her money for snacks, apparently. It's not clear if she met her at school before she left or if she met her at the bowling alley, like at the beginning of it. But from what I understand, and accounts do differ somewhat from different newspaper articles, but it does sound like Sandy saw her that afternoon.
But we're unclear as to whether it was at school. It was definitely before bowling.
It was before bowling. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I'm just trying to get a solid timeline here.
Well, yeah. And so that's the thing, because when bowling was over, one of Stephanie's friend's mothers saw her as they were leaving because she had come to pick up her child, who was also in the bowling league. So she saw Stephanie, you know, they're in the car, they're getting ready to leave the parking lot. They see Stephanie and the mom asks her if she wants a ride. But Stephanie's house was literally 500 yards away.
Right.
So Stephanie's like, nah, I'm good. Yeah. You know, don't worry about it. Stephanie's house was on the other side of Garden Creek, and she had to cross a footbridge to get there. And as her friend and her mom were leaving, they saw Stephanie heading toward the footbridge in the direction of her house.
Okay. What's the setting for the footbridge? Like, kind of park-like? It's crossing a creek, right?
Yeah, but like a very like shallow creek.
Okay. I'm just wondering whether it's wooded.
Yeah, it is kind of wooded. Yeah. Okay. But not like, you know, in the middle of the woods.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, no, certainly it is a wooded area.
Yeah, so it's not like crossing over a creek surrounded by fields or anything.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Stephanie's friend's mother didn't see anybody else around, nothing odd.
Nothing weird.
What about the people in the bowling alley? Did they say that they saw...
I'm going to get to that.
Okay. Sorry, I'm jumping the gun. Okay,
I know. We've been gone for a while, and now you're getting all like, oh, let me ask so many questions. Like, let me do it, man.
Okay, sorry.
So things did get weird, though, right after this. Like I said, Stephanie's friend's mom, you know, they saw her heading toward the footbridge to her house, like normal. But just a few minutes later, Stephanie's best friend, Brandy, and her mother saw Stephanie heading in the opposite direction, waiting to cross the highway. They thought that was weird, obviously, so they stopped to ask Stephanie if she wanted a ride to, like, wherever she was going. But Stephanie declined, saying that she had forgotten her backpack at the soccer field, so she was just going to run back up to the school to pick it up.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it was a little weird, but, you know, kids forget things all the time. And again, the school was also really close, and Stephanie walked to school on a regular basis. So these are all places that Stephanie was allowed to go, you know? Brandy, her friend, waved goodbye and told Stephanie that she would see her tomorrow. This is all around 4:45, 4:50, like around that time frame. And Stephanie was supposed to be home at 5. With this extra trip to the school, she would have been pushing it. But as long as, you know, her backpack was just on the soccer field, like she thought, like, she would have been more than a few minutes late.
Right. So, I mean, it's all relatively normal.
Exactly.
Activity.
Exactly. In a perfect world, she would have just gone home and, like, told her mom that she left her, you know, backpack, but she probably didn't want to hear about it from her mom. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, the who knows if this was a reoccurring problem.
Right.
And, like, yeah. She doesn't want to get in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. So she's just like, yeah, I'll just go get it. I'll come home. Like, I'll still be home around 5. It won't be a big deal.
Right.
Because Stephanie ultimately was a responsible kid, which is, you know, yes, culturally, these kids had a lot of freedom. But if Stephanie was a screw up, like, her parents wouldn't have let her do all these things on her own either. Because it's not like they were absentee parents. You know, they were around.
No, they just practiced what free range parenting.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that what that trend was in the 2000s?
Yeah, yeah.
This was obviously before
that. This
was
the 90s when it was just called parenting. But yes. So Stephanie's mom, Sandy, was home, and, you know, she had no doubt that Stephanie was going to walk into the door like right around 5 o'clock. But 5 o'clock came and went, and no Stephanie. So this was very unlike her daughter. So Sandy called the bowling alley, just assuming that maybe Stephanie had gotten caught up with friends, or that one of the games had gone long, or just something like that. But the bowling alley employee who she spoke with told her that Stephanie had left a while ago and should have been home by then.
Around what time was this phone call? Like right around 5 or...
Yeah, I mean, like probably like 10 after. Okay. I mean, yeah, because if Stephanie
was... It's not
was,
like she waited... A half hour. Or 45
no, not
minutes.
At all. Because Okay. Again, this was just so out of character for her. So, in fact, by 5:15, when she still hadn't heard from her daughter, Sandy was looking for other explanations because she knew she wasn't at the bowling alley, and so she thought, okay, well, maybe she stopped by her grandparents' house, because Stephanie's grandparents, Earl and Hazel Crane, lived right next door.
Interesting.
Yeah, small town Idaho. It's not like Stephanie would usually just drop by her grandparents' house if she was supposed to be home at a certain time, but it wasn't the strangest possibility.
I mean, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Like, they're right there.
Exactly.
Like, that's a logical conclusion. Like, you know, she's not here. She's always here around this time.
Yeah.
Maybe she's next door.
Yeah. So she calls Hazel, and of course, they had not heard from their granddaughter. Now, once Stacy explained what was going on, though, Hazel started to worry as well. So she and Stacy got in the car and started looking for Stephanie. As the sun began to set and they still couldn't find the 9-year-old, the pit in both of their stomachs started to grow. They knew there was no way Stephanie would willingly be out after dark. Though she was, you know, rough and tumble and outdoorsy, Stephanie was absolutely terrified of the dark. Now, this fear was so great that Stephanie rarely spent the night at her beloved grandparents' home.
Really?
Yeah, because she wanted to be in her own bed after dark.
Hmm.
Even when she was home, she slept with her bedroom light on. And that was something that, like, her friends, like Brandy, has done interviews and stuff like that. And they would say that, too. They're like, yeah, it was weird when we had sleepovers because there were always lights on. Yeah,
the light was on full blast.
Yeah.
Not just a night light.
Right. Like, straight up a light. So, but, you know, despite all this, Stacy and Hazel were still grasping for a reasonable explanation for Stephanie's disappearance. So once they returned home, they called all of her friends, hoping that she had just gone home with one of them from the bowling alley and forgotten to call. But none of them had seen Stephanie. By 8 p.m., the family had exhausted all reasonable explanations for Stephanie being gone, so Stacy finally accepted that something terrible had happened to her daughter. She drove down to the Custer County Sheriff's Office and reported Stephanie missing. And I do find this part of the story interesting because a lot of times when there's like a gap in a child being reported missing, you know, several hours in this case, we're talking about 3 hours, people are like, well, how could you wait? Like, how could you not immediately report it? But I mean, it completely makes sense to me because you just don't want to believe that something crazy happened.
Well, yeah. And even beyond that, I mean, it's not like they weren't doing anything for those 3 hours.
Yeah.
They were out looking for, assuming that they would find her either with one of her friends or whatever.
You know, there have just been so many cases that I've researched where something very similar happened. Like the family goes out and starts looking for the child and doesn't call the police yet. And then that comes back to be like, oh, well, what were, you know, why didn't they call the police? What are they hiding?
Well, yeah. And okay, let's take it from the police's perspective. Like, realistically, do you think that the police are going to be like, all hands on deck, let's go run around this neighborhood looking for this missing kid when they've been missing for 20 minutes?
Yeah, like they're homecoming late from bowling. Like,
yeah,
no, they're not.
Right.
But, you know, interestingly, the benefit of the small town in this case is, you know, because children don't go missing in Chalice, like deputies actually took Stacy's report seriously, even though it was only 3 hours after she had last been seen. Their first thought wasn't that somebody had done something to Stephanie. It was that she had had some sort of accident.
Yeah, that's logical.
Yeah. So after learning about her route home, they immediately went to that creek to see if there was a possibility that she had like fallen in and either injured herself or, you know, drowned.
Oh, is it that? Well, I guess you can drown.
You can drown in, yeah, any amount
inches
of water.
Yeah,
so that was certainly a possibility, however unlikely. But fortunately for the search efforts, the creek was shallow and didn't have a strong current, so they were able to search it very quickly and rule that possibility out. So that allowed them to quickly expand their search. By 9 p.m., news had spread around town of Stephanie's disappearance, and the community came out in force to assist. Dozens of residents came out to search, along with firefighters, sheriff's deputies, and members of the county's search and rescue group. They even brought out a tracking dog that was able to pick up Stephanie's scent near the bowling alley. It quickly lost her scent, though, and was unable to determine which direction the 9-year-old had traveled.
Obviously, we know that she was headed across that footbridge, probably realized she didn't have her backpack, turned around, started heading the opposite direction towards school.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in knowing where in the opposite direction towards the school the dog lost her scent. If it was on the street or, you know what I mean?
Right, like on the highway.
Right.
Because she was seen trying to cross the highway. So yeah, I don't know exactly where the dog lost the scent. But yes, it would be interesting to know if it was like on the highway or closer to the school or whatever.
I mean, if we're talking kidnapping or abduction, like that's the X.
The search was eventually called off at midnight, but resumed as soon as the sun rose the next morning. Now that day, in addition to searchers on horseback, in trucks and ATVs, a specialized search and rescue group from Blaine County was also brought in. Businesses in town either closed completely or opened with a minimum number of employees, allowing as many residents as possible to search.
Wow.
Classes were even canceled for upperclassmen at the local high school so they could join in on the search.
Well, this really is small town.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was all hands on deck. Nearly every window in town had a flyer with Stephanie's photo on it. Stephanie's schoolmates made buttons that said, "Bring Stephanie home and help us find Stephanie." They put purple borders on the buttons for Stephanie's favorite color. By day three, over 1,000 people were searching for Stephanie, not only in Custer County, but in neighboring Lemhi County as well. Unfortunately, no trace of the girl was found, and by Thursday, the fourth day of the search, investigators decided to scale back the physical search.
Why?
Because they realized if Stephanie had simply gotten lost, they would have found her by now. Mm. I mean, they had a full physical search for 4 days in a tiny area, and we're talking about a very short window of time. So if Stephanie had just gotten lost or something had happened to her without outside assistance, there's no way they wouldn't have come across her at that point.
Are we assuming that within this physical search, they did door-to-doors as well?
Yeah, I mean, but also everybody was out. Like, you know?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more with the neighboring counties.
I mean, I don't know that they did door-to-doors in the neighboring counties, but yes, I mean, physically, but they did a physical search very much in town and then, you know, expanded it, but probably not door-to-doors that far out. Because it was day four and they hadn't found Stephanie, they were forced to face a much darker possibility that there had been an abduction. Now, before the physical search was scaled back, Stephanie's disappearance had started to hit the papers, and this led citizens to call in with tips. Several people reported seeing a bright yellow pickup truck with red pinstripes that they didn't recognize on the day of Stephanie's disappearance. The truck was seen near Stephanie's school, and because Challis was such a small town, people noticed when a new car showed up.
Well, especially yellow with pinstripes.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, no one, you know, had thought to write down the license plate numbers. I mean, they were nosy, but like they weren't that nosy.
Right. Yeah.
Because at the time they had no, you know, they didn't know Stephanie was missing or that anything was wrong. So police were unable to identify the owner. And, you know, I'll just take that to mean that nobody in Challis, Idaho had a yellow pickup truck with red pinstripes registered to them.
Yeah, sure.
Investigators continued to ask the public for leads with increasing desperation. By Thursday, the Crane family began to retreat into themselves and were said to be shaken by the unsuccessful search. Custer County Sheriff Dispatcher Melanie Hawkins told the Idaho Statesman, quote, "They thought they'd have their daughter back by now," end quote. One challenge that the investigation ran into was that it happened to be in the middle of deer and elk hunting season.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So this meant that the normally sleepy town and Highway 93 were filled with strangers coming and going.
Mm.
Stephanie was last seen near the highway, so one of the early theories is that she was kidnapped by someone who just happened to see her standing there. Volunteers printed out thousands of flyers and distributed them to hunters, but no leads came of it. Though the physical searches were eventually scaled back, the Challis community did not give up. Many dogged searchers combed and recombed the woods, and donors raised $50,000 as a reward for Stephanie's safe return. In addition to locals making flyers, the Kevin Collins Foundation for Missing Children also sent out about 400,000 flyers within a week of Stephanie's disappearance. Challis High School's homecoming celebration went on as scheduled that weekend, but it was a much different event than in years past. It was filled with banners that said, "Bring Stephanie home," and was decorated with purple, which, like I said before, was her favorite color. The football games were dedicated to her safe return and began with a moment of silence for the missing girl. Each player wore a purple S on his helmet. As the children who were with Stephanie at the bowling alley were interviewed, they mentioned a creepy man who was watching them bowl. A composite sketch was made based on their descriptions, but Sheriff Al Finley downplayed its importance to reporters, saying that it was a, quote, "vague investigative lead," end quote, and that he didn't mean for it to get released to the public. He said that they had interviewed a few people who bore a resemblance to the drawing, but they were able to rule them out. So from what it sounds like this, there's a whole thing with this sketch. It sounds like it got leaked to the press and it wasn't really finished yet. Like it wasn't in its final form. And so Sheriff Finley, you know, was concerned about it getting out because it, you know, was pretty generic and looked like a lot of people, you know? And so he was concerned about people getting wrongfully accused and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, especially considering if this is such a small town and you could very quickly interview the employees at the bowling alley.
Right.
And rule out that they're, you know, that this was not like a stranger or somebody that's being creepy or whatever, that maybe this is just something that the kids, not to dismiss what they were remembering, but in hindsight, thinking somebody was creepier than they actually were. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, just from a more practical standpoint, if you're interviewing a bunch of kids for a physical description, I think it's going to be tough to get the most accurate one, you know?
Yeah.
As the weeks went on, the investigation lost its frenzied pace, but was still very much underway. On October 28th, it was announced that the task force was revived to investigate new leads in Stephanie's disappearance. Police declined to give details, but the next day, it was reported that Custer County authorities issued a statewide alert for 43-year-old Robert Paul Crane, Stephanie's great-uncle. Police said he was wanted for questioning in Stephanie's disappearance, as well as for a probation violation. They warned that he may also be armed and dangerous. Crane was known to drive both a motorhome and a yellow Datsun pickup truck.
A yellow Datsun?
Mm-hmm. The Custer County Chief Deputy told reporters, quote, "We're not saying he's a suspect, but he was possibly the driver of that vehicle," end quote, referring, of course, to the yellow pickup truck with red pinstripes that they had been searching for. Now, Robert Crane was the brother of Earl Crane, Stephanie's grandfather. Stephanie's grandmother, Hazel, said that the family hadn't seen Robert in a few years. So, you know, as far as she knew, he wasn't even in the area at the time. And it should also be noted that the probation violation, you know, that they were trying to get him on wasn't for a violent crime. It was for a felony DUI conviction, though he had previously been arrested twice for battery. So again, you know, he does have a slightly violent past.
Right. But as far as we know, he hasn't been around for years.
Right. Right.
So why?
I think because
completely out of the blue would I get it because of the truck.
Yeah. And it's somebody close to Stephanie and, you know, closer than a stranger.
Yes. So you definitely have to pursue that lead.
Yeah.
That seems like a stretch, just out of the blue. He's going to come out of nowhere and abduct
and, like, kidnap
Stephanie.
His, yeah, I know. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you get why they had to do it, especially when they had no other leads.
Yeah.
When Hazel was asked about what she thought of her husband's brother potentially being involved in Stephanie's kidnapping, she replied, quote, "I'd better not answer that," end quote.
Okay.
Robert Paul Crane was found and arrested in Colorado on November 4th. When he was found, Crane told Les Stimson with the Idaho Bureau of Investigation that he was nowhere near Chalice when his great-niece was abducted on October 11th. He claimed that he had been working as a logger and hadn't even heard about Stephanie's kidnapping.
So easily verifiable.
Yeah,
alibi.
Right. For the most part. And of course, it took time to do so. But sure. Yeah, that's what the Idaho Bureau of Investigation started working on. You know, like, OK, is he telling the truth? Was he in Colorado or could he have been in Idaho? So it did take a while, like a full month, but by the beginning of December, police did rule out Robert Paul Crane as a suspect, saying his alibi had checked out. A week and a half before Stephanie was kidnapped, however, 12-year-old Polly Klass was abducted from her Petaluma, California bedroom at knife point. As investigators ruled out Crane, they began to look for possible connections between those two abductions.
In California?
Yeah.
I mean, between Idaho and California, I would assume there's probably a lot of kids that have gotten abducted.
But not in that way. Like, not stranger abductions, two little girls who are close to the same age. I mean, those, they don't happen that often.
I mean, yeah, I understand that that's not like a Saturday night occurrence, but it just, I'm wondering, other than just the known, I'm wondering what else connected it. Because, I mean, we don't know of anything at knife point. Stephanie wasn't taken out of her home.
At the time, a man named Richard Allen Davis was the chief suspect in Polly's abduction, and he was a bit of a transient. So I think that they were thinking there was a possibility that, you know, he had been driving back and forth or something. They were grasping at straws, but the Polly class abduction was a huge case. And again, these just don't happen very often. The day after investigators made the statement to reporters about Stephanie's great uncle having an alibi, Davis confessed to strangling Polly to death and burying her along Highway 101. He was later convicted for her abduction and murder and remains on death row to this day. But he was living in a California halfway house at the time of Stephanie's abduction and was eventually cleared by police in this case. Stephanie's case grew colder and colder as the months went on, and the Crane family began to fall apart. Sandy and Ben's marriage disintegrated, and she left the family and moved to Nevada.
Family in Nevada or just?
No, she just moved to Nevada by herself and left her kids behind in Idaho.
Wow.
She died 2 years later at the age of 32.
Jesus. From what?
I believe it was either a pulmonary embolism or an aneurysm of some sort, but it was something very sudden. And Hazel says that, you know, as far as she's concerned, she just died of grief. Ben eventually moved his children out of Chalice in an attempt to start over. But he died in 2012, leaving Stephanie's three sisters behind. And he was only like in his early 50s. He died of a heart attack, I believe. The Custer County Sheriff's Office continues to follow any leads they get, though years sometimes pass between them. A nonprofit called the Child Connection, Inc. performed searches in Custer County in 1994 and in 1997. But in April of 2000, police in Canyon County, Idaho, received an interesting call. An inmate in Canyon County Jail said that he had a female friend who knew the person responsible for Stephanie's abduction. Detectives reached out to the friend, who agreed to be interviewed. According to her, in 1993, she rented a room from a man in Nampa, Idaho, about 200 miles from Chalice. The guy from whom she rented the room was a drifter who has not been publicly named by law enforcement. She said that this home in Nampa had a basement that was off limits to everyone, and that neighbors told her they had heard sounds of a young girl screaming and crying down there. She asked the man about it, but he said it was his daughter.
I mean, okay, whether it's your daughter or not, why is she locked in the basement screaming?
Well, he told her that she was in the basement because she kept running away.
What the So she's a prisoner now?
Yeah. This woman, you know, who's talking to police was never able to get into the basement to see for herself. But one day when this guy was gone, she went through his things and found several pairs of what appeared to be young girls' underwear.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. Now, this woman apparently had children of her own living in this home, so she packed up and left. But neither she nor the neighbors who had told her that they had heard the screaming contacted authorities. So after this incredibly disturbing story, Canyon County did some digging and found that this man had been arrested in Oregon in 1992 on charges that he sexually abused his young daughter.
Okay.
He was convicted, but served no jail time and was only sentenced to probation.
Ooh, okay. And what happened to his daughter? Was she still with him?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, after he was sentenced to probation, he moved to Idaho, to Nampa.
Jesus, so that could actually have been his daughter in the basement.
It could have been, yeah. So in May 2000, which is when this is all coming out, the man was located and brought in for an interview. He agreed to take a polygraph, and according to police, he failed. They were also able to obtain a search warrant for that home in Nampa. Though, you know, I don't think he lived there any longer. I think it was, you know, owned or rented or whatever by other people. Investigators searched the basement and found mattresses, rope, strands of hair, and what appeared to be bloodstains on the floor.
So this is 7 years after the abduction.
Correct.
And this house is now owned or occupied
It honestly could have been abandoned for all I know. All I know is that he was not living there any longer. But no, I know either way, it's like, insane that all that stuff was still there.
Still there. Yeah. Jesus. I mean, were they able to get any kind of DNA or anything?
Well, they collected samples, but all of the tests came back inconclusive.
Yeah.
So no definitive link to Stephanie was able to be made. Police also attempted to put this man in a photo lineup, hoping that employees from the bowling alley could identify him as, you know, maybe the creepy guy that everybody had seen.
Sure, but this is, again, 7 years later.
Right, and no one was able to identify him. So police were forced to release the man without charges. But 2 years later, in 2002, another suspect emerged, and this time he had a name. On June 5th, 2002, 42-year-old Keith Glenn Hescock led sheriff's deputies on a chase through three eastern Idaho counties before ending up at Targhee National Forest, where he shot himself in the head, killing himself. He also shot a sheriff's deputy and a police dog before he did that.
Oh, no.
I know. Yeah, the sheriff's deputy survived. I don't think the dog did. Hescock had previously served 2 years in an Oregon prison for burglary convictions. The chase began after he was suspected of kidnapping a 14-year-old girl who had been sleeping on a trampoline with her sister in their backyard.
Well, that's terrifying.
Hescock allegedly took the girl to his home where he chained her to furniture and then went to work. This girl is amazing. She was able to free her hands and grab a fire extinguisher, which she banged on the chains that were holding her feet for 2 hours before she was able to break them.
Wow.
She then found some mail in the home that had the address on it, and she called a family friend, told the friend where she was, and was able to be rescued.
That's really smart.
I know.
Good for her.
Yeah. So when Hescock arrived home from work, deputies were there waiting for him, and the chase began. Prior to the kidnapping and his death, Hescock had been a suspect in the September 2001 abduction of 20-year-old Amber Hoops, as he had previously worked at her grandparents' auto body shop. He was questioned in her case, but was never arrested due to a lack of evidence. Because again, this was a disappearance, so they didn't have any physical evidence to potentially tie him to the crime.
Right.
All right, but how does this all connect to Stephanie? Police had reports that Hescock may have been hunting in the Challis area when Stephanie disappeared. He also owned a yellow pickup truck. However, Hescock had connections to both Hoops' family and the family of the 14-year-old girl he abducted. No such connection could be found to Stephanie's family.
Right, but that doesn't rule out a crime of opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And many did speculate that that's exactly what it was. You know, obviously, he's a bad guy. And while he probably didn't plan Stephanie's abduction, you know, he easily could have done it after he came across her. Unfortunately, no further evidence has linked Hescock to Stephanie's abduction. And as for Amber Hoops, she has still never been found. After reaching a dead end with Hescock, investigators have questioned the drifter, but have been unable to come up with any more evidence. What I am still confused about on some level is why, after all this time, police haven't named this man. Because, you know, I get that if he had nothing to do with it, like we run into this in a lot of cases, right? Where police are hesitant to publicly name people that they're interviewing in a case because they don't want them to be like negatively associated with something that they had nothing to do with.
Right.
But this guy hasn't been ruled out. They just haven't been able to find enough evidence to say that he did it. And he's a convicted felon.
Right.
Though he didn't, you know, serve jail time for sexually abusing his child. Like, I just don't see the downside of publicly naming him as a person of interest, because if you have his name, there might be somebody out there who does know something.
Yeah, well, no, 100%. Especially, you know, with how many years have passed, like, what could it hurt?
Exactly, right? I mean, you know, I just don't understand. Like, this guy clearly wasn't very private about the horrible acts that he was committing. And there may be more people out there besides this, you know, one-time roommate who could, if not give evidence in Stephanie's case, maybe give evidence in another case that we don't even know about, you know?
Right.
I just don't see the downside, because I don't, how are we supposed to generate new leads in Stephanie's case if this man is actually involved, if there's no place to start, you know?
So we have this guy. We know that he has a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where's his daughter now?
Right, exactly. And, you know, definitely I don't want her publicly named, because she's obviously been through enough. But yeah, I think that it would be important for police to talk to her to see if that was her in the basement in 1993.
Yeah.
If it was or it wasn't, that would give a lot of information. But, you know, what did she know? Like, were there other girls? Like,
right. What did she see?
Yeah.
When she was locked in the basement?
Yeah, and I don't know for sure that, you know, the Idaho Bureau of Investigation or Custer County or anybody, I don't know that they haven't talked to her.
So one would assume that they have, but
I wouldn't assume anything.
That's fair. But if they have spoken to her, whatever she said didn't rule him out. So that leads me to believe that there's way more to this story with this guy than they're letting on. Which is fine, but again, I don't see the harm in releasing his name at this point.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think that's the most frustrating thing about this at the moment, because, you know, he is seemingly a viable suspect. And again, without a name, you know, how are you supposed to generate more leads from the public? Because with a cold case like this, I mean, that's kind of what you need. You know, you need help from the public. So I don't know. I mean, and again, this guy could be completely innocent and he could just be another Idaho scumbag. Like, I don't know, but it's hard to make a determination one way or another. And if he's not involved, like, maybe there's another man out there who people knew was doing things like this, you know, that they didn't necessarily know that Stephanie had anything to do with it, but they knew that he was hurting little girls or something. And so maybe there are people out there who have information or suspicions about someone they know who was around Challice, Idaho in 1993. Because somebody was. I don't think there's a possibility where somebody wasn't involved in Stephanie's disappearance, whether it's this drifter or a hunter or some other third party.
Yeah, no, she didn't just disappear or go missing or get lost on the way to school or something like that.
And stay lost for 30 years.
Right.
Stephanie's parents didn't live long enough to find out what happened to their little girl, but there are still plenty of people in her family who are out there and desperate for answers. Stephanie Lynn Crane has been missing from Challice, Idaho since October 11, 1993. She is a white female with brown hair and blue eyes. She has a scar near her right eye and freckles on her face. She is approximately 4'2" and between 65 and 85 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was last seen wearing a maroon and white striped hoodie with Gimme printed on the front in white lettering, maroon sweatpants, and maroon and white shoes. Stephanie was 9 years old when she went missing. She would be 38 today. There is a $50,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for Stephanie's disappearance. If you think you have information about Stephanie, please call the Custer County Sheriff's Office at 208 879-2232, or you can call the Custer County Sheriff Tip Line at 208-879-5372 and leave a message. You can also call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
Be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.